Hi, I'm Chloe McCulloch, editorial director of Building Magazine. This year is the 180th anniversary of our publication, and to mark this, we've launched the Building the Future Commission, one aspect of which looks at how we can build sustainable and desirable communities that people actually want to live in. The Commission is looking for best practice in urban design, and this is the accompanying podcast. Welcome to Building Talks, Creating Communities. New developments can face massive opposition, attacked for poor design, a lack of public services, and low quality civic space. These are the challenges we'll be tackling in this podcast by talking to built environment professionals. We'll explore their personal stories, influences, and motivations. And we'll ask, why is there so much interest in the placemaking agenda? And how can we make the places we work and live in better? Hello, and welcome to the Building Talks Creating Communities podcast. I'm Chloe McCulloch, and as usual, I'm joined by my colleague Ben Flatman, who has spent the last few weeks talking to key players in this field. Hi Ben, tell us about this week's guest.
Hi Chloe, this week's guest is Selina Mason. She's Director of Master Planning at Lendlease, which is one of the UK's biggest developers. The reason I wanted to speak to Selina is she's got a huge wealth of experience. She worked on the Olympic Delivery Authority and the London Legacy Development Corporation. And as director at Lendlease, she has this very high-level perspective of big projects. One example would be the Smithfield project in Birmingham, where a huge site has become available in the middle of the city centre, and Lendlease had this opportunity to literally create a new piece of city. I think that gives Selina a very unique perspective on a lot of these issues.
Okay, Ben, let's have a listen. This is Selina Mason, Director of Master Planning at Lendlease.
Hello, Selina. It's brilliant to have you as a guest on the podcast today. Thanks so much for joining. I understand that you're recording today from IQL Stratford, which is a Lendlease development in East London. I was wondering if you could just tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, absolutely. First of all, thank you very much for the invitation to chat to you today. It'll be an interesting conversation, I'm sure. And I'm in the site office at IQL. International Quarter essentially for those that know the Olympic Park, it's the piece of land that sits between Westfield Shopping Centre and the Olympic Park at the southern end. So if you ever go to the stadium, for instance, you would walk through IQL Stratford.
Thanks, Selina. I know you've got a sort of long connection to that part of London as well, which we'll discuss later in the podcast. The theme of this series of podcasts is creating communities. Initially, I was sort of rather naively referring to it as placemaking. Almost everybody who's come on to the podcast has actually sort of questioned the validity of that term. I think there's a sort of widely held view that if we look across the whole of the UK, we're still not sort of consistently creating the high quality places for people to live and work that we'd like to see. So I just wanted to ask you, why is it that this area is so important? And what do you see as the sort of key challenges for people working in your sector when trying to create or reinvigorate a sense of place?
It's super important. And, you know, I take all the views around the word placemaking as being, it's a relevant conversation because there's so much of what we do in development that is very much top-down, and it really shouldn't be like that. And placemaking is a kind of shorthand that we use in the industry that isn't always received outside that line of an industry conversation in the same way we'd expect it to. It does feel very, this is being done to me, not with me, type of word. But I think the fundamentals of it, I think you're making a place that feels relevant and useful to the people that live and work there. And that's, I think, something that we often lose sight of. It's very difficult to focus on when development is so transfixed, for obvious reasons, by making money. So I don't think you can really go wrong if you start with Yangel's statement around first life, then spaces, then buildings, because that really does bring to the fore the whole purpose of a place, which is to support those who live and work there in a way that makes it easier for their lives. Going to your bigger point about whether the UK is good enough at this, I think that's probably the start of it, isn't it? It's around how places create equity, how they respond to everybody, and how they can create better outcomes for everybody, not just for the few.
I'd like to ask you a little bit about your personal journey as well, your sort of background and influences, and what got you interested in urban design, creating communities originally.
I grew up with a father particularly who was very interested in architecture. My parents commissioned an architect when I was about 10 to work on a rundown stable building they had bought in Norfolk, and that, you know, they made it our home. That was, I think, a really transformative thing for me, you know, to actually see an architect and builders at work creating something that was for us. So I think that had a lasting impact. And then subsequently, I guess in university, I kind of always did have this tendency to want to look at the bigger picture. I was always more interested, I guess, in the front end of the project when you were looking at the kind of what's the setting for this building, you know, that first few weeks of an architecture study project. I was working with Long and Kentish on the Maritime Museum down in Falmouth, which is a fantastic project, you know, has contributed in a lasting way to that place. It was really interesting being involved in that because there were some questions that were being asked of that project. How can we deal with the high street to make it more amenable and more attractive to people? If you wanted to solve those sort of problems, you needed to be up the chain. You needed to be in a local authority or in some kind of organization that was dealing with these bigger issues. It was then that I thought, right, I'm going to go and study this. And I went to the LSE and did a master's in urban and regional planning. And I never really looked back from that because the world opened. I was so lucky because CABE had only just been set up when I finished that course. And I went and worked at CABE for 7 years. And that was kind of every minute of learning there was just brilliant. And then it was the Olympics, 7 years on the Olympics. Again, putting all that stuff I'd learned at CABE into practice on a site. And seeing a master plan evolve and be delivered at sort of at pace was, I think, a real privilege. Not many people have that opportunity.
That sort of leads me quite nicely onto my next question, which is whether you can sort of give us an example of where you think sort of best practice has been applied in the UK to this challenge.
I find it really difficult to sort of cite, oh, there's a project that I think is brilliant. You know, as you said right at the beginning, I'm not altogether sure we've done this terribly well. I mean, you know, a lot of people cite King's Cross, and I think King's Cross is great in many, many ways and really set a good benchmark and bar. And actually, when you think about King's Cross, you should really pull it right back to Brinley Place in Birmingham.
Yes. Yeah. I always remind people about
that. Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, coming from Birmingham myself.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And you should keep on doing that because I think Brinley Place was pretty transformative, actually, in the way that people thought about urban development and mixed use and also investment in public realm, which was the big thing there, and I think set an important trajectory for this country. But obviously, because you need to be doing things at scale, it's, you know, we don't do so many of them, and they take a lot longer. They take a long time to get going. So, an inner urban large scale region is not. There aren't that many really in this country, and you know, I have to draw in Elephant Park at this point actually, because I think it's more focused obviously on residential than King's Cross. But I think that the public realm there and the attention to detail in terms of the interface between buildings and the spaces around them is a really strong direction of travel. And I hope that's what we need to be carrying on doing at Lendlease. And I would hope a lot of other people look at that and say, yes, that's what we need to do because it works brilliantly.
Perhaps then the question I'd like to ask you next is, what are the challenges that are being faced by the industry that are preventing us from doing this better?
We have a complete disjuncture between planning and urban design and all that good stuff, and planning policy and urban design policy, all that good stuff, and highways engineering and highways delivery. They're kind of poles apart, both in terms of the design drivers and what good looks like in those different worlds, and how they then come together in a way that actually is productive to both. It's one of the areas that I always look at closely when I look at a project, is how well have they managed that highways public realm building interface. And I think that's where we really need to spend a lot more of our time and energy, particularly as we're heading towards a future where we have to create public realm infrastructure, which is not only much more beneficial to those that live there, but also resilient in terms of climate change. And the amount of carbon that we put into our streets is just beyond belief. You know, that's something I learned on the Olympics, the concrete that gets poured in underneath our road infrastructure is extraordinary.
One of my questions actually was, you know, if CABE was around today, how would its agenda have moved on?
I suspect it would have gone much more towards kind of social value aspects of of development, perhaps done more work around how you can create toolkits and understanding of how to deliver it, you know, what good looks like in that area. Because I think, I mean, if you look at the development community, that's definitely a shift of thinking in recent years, much, much more towards that, as the community has demanded it of us for obvious reasons. It isn't purely about the buildings. I think the cable's very focused on buildings. There was some important work there in terms of schools, hospitals, as well as the broader policy directives around quality in the built environment. But a more comprehensive approach to creating value in its broadest possible sense, I think, is, you would hope that's where they were going.
So you were Director of Architecture and Design Review at CAPE, and then you moved to the Olympic Delivery Authority. After that, you worked with the London Legacy Development Corporation. Was that a sort of seamless transition from the Olympics into the legacy mindset?
The thing that I learned on working on the Olympics was the way in which politics plays its role in these big mega projects. The inevitable, you know, there was inevitable tension between the Department of Culture, Media and Sport, DCMS. But obviously for the GLA, as far as they were concerned, the investment in London was about London and GLA. And so you ended up with this tension between, well, who should own legacy? So that was great. I mean, fascinating experience, and I loved doing it. And the other lesson that I learned from that as well about these big projects is, in the end, there is no one single ownership of them. You have to acknowledge, probably when you start, that you'll only be a fleeting moment in them. No matter how influential you think you are in them, in the end, your role is probably fairly short-lived compared with the lifetime of the whole project. And you have to accept that, and you have to accept that other people have different views about it. If you have a master plan that doesn't ever change or acknowledge any new things, it's probably not a very good master plan, because in the end, cities are they change all the time. They're undergoing constant evolution and change. The market has a big influence on that, and obviously community desires do too. And so it needs to change. It needs to be a flexible platform that can build in new aspirations and new ideas. And if it can't, then it's probably obsolete before you've even finished.
Selina, I'd really like to talk to you about Smithfield in Birmingham. It's perhaps fair to say it's sort of almost unique in a sort of central urban setting in the UK to have such a big plot.
Yeah, I mean, the opportunities, it doesn't take much to see them. You know, as you say, it's re-providing the historic markets and a new town square, a new city square, and residential and commercial buildings around it. So it's a really exciting place. But funnily enough, when Birmingham was redeveloped in the 1960s with the Bullring re-provided, they chose to put the wholesale market on top of this site. And that, I think, had a really curious consequence, because it essentially created barriers right in the heart of the city that has meant that bits of the city, particularly the neighbouring areas of Digbeth to the northwest and south side, they're sort of not quite dead ends, but they don't connect across, because obviously the wholesale market was sitting in the middle. And I think that part, the southern side of Birmingham city centre, has never really functioned as well as it should have done, and historically did, obviously, because that was the foundational point of the city. The city, Digbeth High Street going up the hill past the church and into the Bullring, was the historic thoroughfare.
I know you've made a real effort with the team in Smithfield to bring in young and less known practices.
I think because Smithfield is such a long-term project, it does present us, I think, with a really interesting opportunity to commission smaller, younger practices, particularly diverse practices that perhaps reflect the social environment in Birmingham better. And in doing so, if we get larger practices to work with smaller practices, we perhaps over time can build a bit more capacity within those small practices. You know, they can get bigger. And maybe, you know, maybe one day, the dream is one day one of these small practices that are involved will expand to the point where actually we would commission them to do one of our larger projects.
Sure. I think when we met in Birmingham that time, you mentioned the sort of importance of the rag market and the importance of retail in general to young people is perhaps slightly sort of downplayed or underestimated.
That's all part of growing up, isn't it? And sort of exploring your urban environment. You start to explore those boundaries and you start to learn about your neighbourhood, and urban environments need to help them learn about urban risks and manage those risks. You know, starting to to get a sense of other people around you and starting to be able to identify situations which are safe or unsafe, and you're tuning in, just being able to tune in. So therefore you do need to be thinking about that as you design places and buildings.
The RIBA has just introduced its inclusive design overlay to the RIBA plan of work. I don't know if you've heard about that, but I was just wondering how diversity impacts your thinking.
It's an interesting time, actually, because we're shifting very much away from accessibility and inclusion being purely a physical thing and much more around perception. It was an interesting lesson, I think, I learned from the Olympic Park. Actually, fundamentally, probably one of the most inclusive places in and around the Olympic Park is the shopping centre, it's Westfield. I mean, if you go there, there's wide spectrum and diversity of people who are there, including teenagers, quite comfortable and happy to be hanging out there. It's really worth spending time there just to see how that all works, because that is about creating, in this case, a retail environment that is kind of welcoming and there's no agenda set for anyone. You don't have to be behaving in a certain way.
If you could make sort of three suggestions to improve the quality of community, creating communities and placemaking more generally, what would they be?
Oh, I think, well, one, I'm not sure it's all policy drivers here, actually. I think one is we need to pivot our industry very quickly to a more diverse approach, where we actually do have a much more diverse bunch of people who are leading and managing this kind of, you know, the development of master plans and places. The other thing I think that I've consistently said over the years, and I think this is just something I just have learned and the lesson just keeps on ramming home, is that as professionals, we should just stop focusing on the boundaries between our professions. I just wish that architects, landscape architects, engineers, highways engineers, and the rest would work together better and drive towards better outcomes collectively. I think there's too many sort of professional jealousies and barriers between these professions.
Are you sympathetic then to sort of Michael Gove's suggestion of a school of place? Was that a sort of an idea that resonated at all?
Yeah, I'm sympathetic to anything that breaks down those silos, absolutely. I'm not particularly sympathetic to some kind of idea about a kind of appearance outcome at the end of the day. But certainly anything that creates better connectivity between our professions and less professional jealousy is absolutely 100%. In terms of policy, you know, I think to some extent we possibly have too much policy. You know, that's what it feels like a little bit at the other side at the moment. It's just the pressure on local authority planners to crunch through the amount of policy information and requirements when you've got a big application of the scale of Smithfield or Silvertown is just phenomenal. The London plan, I really worry about it because it's become such a technocratic document. You know, the development control is increasingly just managing other consultants, looking at the work that private sector consultants do. It's just this kind of merry-go-round of developing information to meet the planning policy, and then another lot of consultants are commissioned to check that we've met it. You know, and it's just, I don't think it's productive.
Do you think design coding could play a role there?
A lot of design codes aren't sophisticated enough, I think. But to some extent, again, because we're dealing with some developers that are a bit crude about how they do things, straightforward design codes, fine, tick, yeah, definitely. Let's get the house builders delivering against decent, good design codes. But we still have to think about place as something that goes beyond simply the quality of the environment. I mean, if you look at Northstone, the controversy is currently swirling around it, and its lack of social amenity, that's a design-coded development. So I think codes are part of the answer. We need kind of collective action. We need people pulling the weight. It feels to me like we've become incredibly legalistic, incredibly bureaucratic, and we just need to cut through it and just have some really simple, straightforward conversations about what is this place, what does it mean to us as a community, and how can we make it better for everybody?
Before we let you go, I have three final questions that I've been asking all of the guests on the podcast. The first one is, we will have an idea in our heads of what makes a good place, perhaps what the essence of a good place is. And I just wanted to ask you, can you share with us what's your sort of favourite place?
My favourite place, I often go back to this, is King's Lynn. I mean, King's Lynn in Norfolk. I grew up near King's Lynn, so I have lots of deep, deep memories of being in that town. I gather it's got more listed buildings than any other town in any other similar sized town in the UK. It was part of the Hanseatic League, so at one point it was the sort of trading heart of the British Isles. That history is completely apparent in the town. It's glorious. It's got two big squares, and there's a fantastic high street that connects them. And I have memories as a young child of going into a restaurant and then coming out with the town square flooded. You know, it's very much an edge of the UK place. And it's somewhat forgotten now. You know, it's kind of bypassed. The whole of North Norfolk, to some extent, is a bit bypassed now. It's slightly down at heel in places, but there are some glorious, glorious buildings there. And I think in terms of the kind of history and sense of place, it's so strong. I love it. I love it. Probably because I remember it as a child.
I think there's memories of childhood places that we've been to, just, they do remain incredibly strong. And I think, you know, for architects and urban designers, that they continue to sort of play an influence throughout our lives. So it's really fascinating to hear that. My next question is the Pambury question. It is actually trying to address some really important issues and perhaps deserves to be taken a little bit more seriously than it is.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to knock Pambury. To be honest, I do remember being struck when I went there. They did really double down on high-rise design, and they created some quite interesting lanes and narrow streets. They managed cars quite effectively, I think, in some parts, not all of it, but some parts of it. Certainly better than most extensions. But I think that it suffers from a lot of what urban extensions suffer from, which is this kind of lack of directional purpose. You know, there tend to be blobs attached to a town, another town. So you get this kind of slightly weird concentric circle thing going on in the plan, which I find is really illegible. They've got some parts of it are amazingly legible, and then it drifts because the streets curve away to, in fact, go back to where you started. You're always kind of not quite getting to where you think you ought to be going. Although it's a kind of middle distance legibility, but long distance lack of legibility. But I don't think that's Poundbury's fault. I think that's just, you'll find that in all urban extensions. They're all a bit like that. They're all a little bit weird. And they all have a main road that runs around the edge, and they all suffer from the horrors of buffer zone landscapes, which I absolutely hate.
My final question was, name one person in the industry, not necessarily an architect or urban designer, who you think's really making a positive impact at the moment.
I have a natural tendency not to want to name one person because I love to think of this as a collective
you
endeavor.
Can
but no, I will actually, thinking about it, you know, on reflection, I am prepared to name one person. I think Sadie Morgan is making a huge impact on our industry. You know, her Quality of Life Foundation, the research that they're looking to deliver seems to me, if it delivers what we expect, there'll be some really good stuff coming out of that in terms of exactly what we've been talking about today. You know, how do you make sure that places are going to be there for the benefit of the people that live and work there, not purely for the benefit of those that build them?
Thanks so much, Leah. I'm afraid we've run out of time, and I apologise to our listeners for some of the sound issues that we've had. We've had thunderstorms where I am currently in Argentina, and I think we've had sort of a meeting taking place next door to you, Selena. But thank you again so much for your time.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for inviting me on this. I mean, it's often a really good thing to spend a bit of time just reflecting back, trawling through some memories and relearning those lessons and reinforcing the ones that you walk away with. It's been fascinating. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Building Talks Creating Communities podcast with me, Chloe McCulloch, and Ben Flatman. Our next episode is out on Tuesday. In the meantime, you can find out more about the Building the Future Commission at building.co.uk and more about urban design issues at our sister title, bdonline.co.uk. Thanks for listening and goodbye.